And welcome now to the midday for, let's see, today must be about Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and we'll have a 12:30 quiz question for you today. It has to do with geography. That's going to be fun, I think. You'll have that question. In the meantime, speaking of fun, if you have ever wondered what is the difference between a violinist and a fiddler, we have somebody here to explain that. She's Brandy Berry Benson. She's actually in town at the moment to perform with the Madison Bach musicians, but up from Chicago, and welcome to the midday.
Well, thank you, Norm. Thanks for having me.
So, let's see, you're originally from Texas?
I am. I am originally from College Station, Texas, so Gig and Maggie's for anybody who's out there.
There you go. Yeah. And obviously, then that's where you learn to play that instrument, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, right. Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that back in the day, centuries ago, fiddle and violin were pretty interchangeable. For our purposes, I did learn both classical and fiddling styles as I was growing up. So learned those side by side, which was pretty great to be in a town that had a thriving bluegrass community as well as a thriving fine arts in the schools. So,
and now you play in mostly, I won't call it exactly early music, but early Baroque music and subsequent things to that. And how does that relate to your experience as a fiddler? Because you do play bluegrass.
Yes, right, exactly. I started off getting a regular violin performance degree. I got that at University of North Texas in my undergrad. That's where I also got to learn about Baroque instruments because North Texas at the time had the largest collection or second to largest collection of period instruments. I didn't really know what that meant until I got there to college. So it was great to find that out. I got bit by the early music bug, so to speak, and then went and got my master's degree at Indiana University, which at the time there were only two schools that offered a performance degree, not a musicology degree, in period instruments. So that's what I ended up doing there, about 5 miles away from Bean Blossom, which is Bill Monroe country, oddly enough. One of the things was after I moved to Chicago, I started a group with a co-founder, called the Bach and Beethoven Ensemble at the time, with Curtis Foster, who's now in Seattle. After a couple of years and a little bit of a hiatus, he moved with his partner to the West Coast. And I got in touch with my co-director, Thomas Elaine, for the third time serendipitously in Chicago. We had met in Texas and moved up separately there. And so while we were basically forming the Bach and Beethoven Ensemble, now known as the Bach and Beethoven Experience, and getting that off the ground, I came across a score for a work called The Gentle Shepherd by the Scottish poet Alan Ramsay, who was really big before Robert Burns.
So early 18th century.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So the very first edition would have been 1725. That only had four songs in it. The 1729, and then also the more popular 1795 edition has all 22 songs and shares some similar songs with the Beggar's Opera, with John Gay's Beggar's Opera.
Sure.
Important to note, though, that Alan Ramsay wasn't trying to do the anti-opera like John Gay was. But what's interesting about this work is that it's some of the earliest documentation we have of some of these fiddle tunes. And so I was really pleased to discover that my fiddle world and my classical world intersected in the Baroque period, which is what I love.
So. Aha. So do you have a tune for us that would illustrate that discovery?
Yes, absolutely. So this is my favorite tune that came from this opera. It's called Kirkwood Let Me Be. And shout out to my co-director, Thomas Elaine, if you want to sing along in New York City.
Or anyone else for that matter.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. So here it is. Thank you.
kind of abruptly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it ends on kind of a G major, like kind of weird chord, but yeah. And it only has one text of verse, actually. In the opera, this was where the main lead, Patey, the gentle shepherd, gentle not for meekness, but for his, he's actually was born in, with royal descent. He learns that his estranged father has come back and is actually a royal laird. So he finds out about his noble birth, but he's in love with Peggy, who is a peasant. And so this this tune, Kirkwaud Let Me Be, Kirk being the church, but also representing kind of the government or his duty, his role. You know, he's deciding, should I honor my father and follow in his footsteps, or should I, you know, go with Peggy? So it's kind of a tragic little heartbreak song.
Yeah, I would say that fits fits the mood, mood of the opera. Has anybody performed this opera today?
So we performed it back in 2015, which is the first time that it's been performed in the U.S. since 1798, which was in Philadelphia, apparently. And then since then, though, there was a group, Concerto Caledonia, in Scotland. And actually, I was in touch with that director for a bit, asking him questions about the work, because they performed it as part of the Edinburgh Music Festival in 2001. So.
Well, we're talking about this intersection of classical and you can call it folk music. One of the great collaborators, I guess you could say, was Francesco Geminiani in the early 18th century. Certainly a prominent Baroque composer, but then he made contact with some of these Scottish and Irish performers of the time. And got into some interesting collaborations.
Yes, absolutely. So that also very much pleased me. You know, as I was looking at these intersections, there were really two kind of main distinctions. There were some that were coming from a very folk perspective that were dressed up a little bit more to have some of the idiomatic writings. So, for instance, Francesco Barsanti is one of those in his collection of old Scots tunes. He takes them. He's pretty faithful to the melody with some, you know, it's interesting. You trace a tune actually through fiddle collections of the time and you notice some of the ornamentation that's, you know, reflective of the aesthetic of the time. And so, and this is one of those cases. But he adds, you know, a very Italian approach to the bass line. So there's some interesting harmonies that are coming out that aren't quite Scottish. Geminiani does absolutely the same thing. In fact, he writes whole arrangements of like Oh Bessie Bell and Lass of Petey's Mill and things like that, that you go and you play through these arrangements and it's like you can definitely tell the Geminiani part, which is probably about 75-80% of it. And then, you know, and then you have the tune itself, because he actually fleshes these out to include two violins, viola, cello, harpsichord, you know, so
standard,
ensemble
pretty standard of the early 18th century.
Right, exactly. So it kind of poses an interesting question, you know, when you get these like fusions, if you will, like how much is the folk side and how much is, you know, that Baroque side that's being brought in. And I think James Oswald is another example, And in fact, he appears, some of his tunes appear under the name David Rizzio in Geminiani's collections. So
that's a name that turns up in Scotland, isn't it? History, Rizzio.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so you, so in like his Art of the True Taste of Music and things like this, you have these tunes that are fleshed out with very Geminiani ornamentation and things like that. He shows the kind of the blank tune, but, you know, even the blank tune doesn't show, you know, the Scottish ornamentation that you would have.
Sure.
So it's a very interesting.
Get into some interesting conjectures. If the earliest source you can find is somebody like Geminiani, you can kind of extrapolate, I suppose, as to what the original tune would have been like in Scotland.
Right. Well, and thankfully we do have some earlier sources, and then we also have some sources that are a little more true, or I guess I should say that are a bit, you know, they're by a Scotsman, and so therefore very much more Scottish. So we have, you know, sources from like Giuseppe, or I'm sorry, we also have some sources from Abraham McIntosh, and, you know, some earlier, not too early. I mean, Really, there's like two texts out there by James Johnson that talk about 18th century Scotland. And so it seems like maybe the Irish were a little bit better about documenting their music than the Scots were. I don't know. So
let's see. Well, you have some Irish stuff, too, under your fingers there.
Yeah, there's so this collection called the Hibernian Muse, it was actually first published in London before Dublin. And I came across this tune called St. Patrick's Day, which I thought was really neat that there was something like that. But what's interesting about this particular version is that it's different than James Oswald's version and different from some other versions you might see in some dance collections, because in the dance collections, there's an added couple of bars to accommodate the dance step.
That's a good distinction, isn't
right,
it?
Right, yeah.
Music mm-hmm. that's about dancing and music you can actually dance to.
Right, exactly. And I should mention, actually, the Barsanti collection put slow next to a lot of the tunes. And I asked, there's a Scottish fiddler, terrific fiddler in Chicago named Tim McDonald. And he's done a lot of research on early Scottish repertoire and plays on a period instrument. And in fact, was the first to win the Scottish National Championship in the U.S. on a Baroque violin. And so I talked with him about it. And he said, well, slow or slowish just means not suitable for dancing. And so the Barsanti collection certainly reflects that.
So this is St. Patrick's Day then?
So St. Patrick's Day, yep, from the Hibernian Muse.
That's certainly a tune that if you've listened to much Irish music, you would be familiar with. Even in the collection of Irish brigade songs from the Civil War, that tune with lyrics put to it.
Yeah.
And that was just called St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
Well, what about the intersection, as long as we're talking about intersections between types of music, between folk music and classical music and hymns?
Right. Well, so this brings up an interesting point, too, because as part of a collaboration that the Bach and Beethoven Experience is doing with Bella Voce, we're doing a program of the sacred and profane Scottish music. So, of course, a lot of these folk melodies are appearing in some of the religious collections as well. And so so I found a tune in the collection by James Davies. The collection is called The Choice Collection of the Most Admired Psalms and Hymn Tunes. And in that collection, the tune is called Powell. But in fiddle collections, it's called Tweedside.
Of course.
Yes, right. So there's a real distinction between the sacred and the secular. But and he is pretty faithful to the melody. This is a later collection, so this was like just around the turn of the 19th century, so like, you know, 1800, and so you have some, you notice like some of the appoggiaturas and some of the other things that are a little more particular to that century as well. But what's interesting is that he fleshes it out to include several voices, another like little descant line. And so it's again, it's a folk tune, but that's been dressed up a bit. So we'll call it Tweedside, yeah. That's how I think the folk musicians would know it, yeah. So.
Thank you.
go. Tweedside, also known as Powell.
Yes, also known as Powell. This tune also appears in The Gentle Shepherd, so it's a very, very well-known tune. It appears in James Oswald's Caledonian Pocket Companion collection with lots and lots of variations and a different key also. So,
for various purposes, various instruments, yes. We imagine, according
exactly.
to which key is the best match.
Yeah.
And so how many of these songs are there in these collections, all these Scottish songs?
Oh, gosh, a lot. at least for the, I can speak for at least the Caledonian Pocket Companion has 8 volumes, but I think there's up to 12, actually. And then, there's a number, I have no idea, actually, how many of the psalms and hymn tunes are in the James Davies collection. But I know in other collections that have Strathspeys and Riggs and, reels and jigs and things, that there's hundreds, so...
Strathspey, which is easier to play maybe than it is to say,
is a
singularly Scottish dance, isn't it? I haven't seen it in any other context.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And I don't have that for today, but I do have. There is a reel, and actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about this too, because a jig rather. In the notation, and this is true for Baroque music too. Sometimes you have a rhythmic notation that's printed on the page, but there's an alteration that you. That you know to do. So like the French Baroque know to do any gall in certain cases for the stepwise scalar passages.
It's kind of an idiomatic thing.
Yeah, they know to do that. There's a similar phenomenon in Scottish music as well. So particularly for the jigs. And Abraham McIntosh collection there, which is, it's just called like a collection of Strathspeys, reels and jigs, etc. but there's a tune called The Sailors All at the Bar.
Kind of bar is this referring to?
Yeah, well, there's lots to choose from in Madison. So.
Okay.
And in Scotland too. Right?
So, no doubt.
But what's interesting is that it's written as straight eighth notes. So on the page, I could play it something like this. But actually the convention is that you snap the rhythm a bit.
That's a very Scottish thing, isn't it, that snap?
Yeah, so the...
Well, that snap, correct me if I'm wrong, Brandy, but that snap then starts to put a little bit of a bluegrass spin to it.
Yeah, just a little bit. And maybe snap is not really the right word, because there is a snap, in Scottish music that's not that. It's like this ba-dum, ba-dum,
right,
ba-dum.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe I should use a different word for that alteration of the rhythm.
See it in the Scottish poetry, too, of the time. There's this kind of jump. This leap that you get in phrases.
Right, exactly. And that was an interesting thing too, looking at The Gentle Shepherd, like the poetic text of the libretto and some of the words, you can kind of tell that sometimes the accent in Scottish language by the endings of the words, so that's just an interesting tidbit to throw out there.
But a lot of these tunes I'm gathering from these vast collections that you've referred to do gradually make their way into, bluegrass and popular music too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so there's a lot of that. That'll be the BBE's next musical journey next summer. We'll be researching a bit more that crossover from, continental Europe into the U.S. and how, or mostly the British Isles, how that came over and the different versions that show up.
Including some of that Acadian stuff.
Oh yes,
Acadian goes to Cajun.
Yeah, right, exactly. We have a program coming up this summer. We'll have a banjo for the first time, which is pretty awesome.
not to be heard too often in early music.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so we're delving in a little bit later, but basically how French ballads and other fiddle styles contributed to, you know, we're calling it Journey Over the Atlantic, Shimmy Down the Mississippi River, and there you get and exploring those cultural exchanges and fiddle styles that led up to the Cajun, pre-Cajun music, pre the arrival of the accordion. But what caused me to take note of this was that a lot of Cajun fiddlers tune down. They all play with kind of the swingy Enigal-like style.
Right.
And they tune down to accommodate the C diatonic organ. And so they're, accordion, I'm sorry. And so the strings are tuned a whole step lower, which is, you know, what you would do for a lot of French Baroque, 17th century French Baroque music.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You run across that retuning a lot, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Over the years.
Yes.
So this, and I know you have other things to do here in a minute, and we got this quiz question too shortly, but this Bach and Beethoven experience?
Yes.
What exactly is that?
Right. So basically, we are a music ensemble, and we are on period instruments, and we explore music as early as 16th, 17th century into today. So we do new music on period instruments as well. And basically, we're about the experience and transforming the whole concert package. So being in some non-traditional venues, exploring some non-traditional topics, such as this French Baroque Cajun connection and other things like that. I mean, the new music thing is a big thing for us. We have a big program in the fall, Chicago Stories, that the composers are writing about, using the stories of the people in different neighborhoods in Chicago and writing pieces about them. So that's been a really, really cool thing to just find out more about your city and your neighbors.
Sure.
So.
And in the meantime, you're going to be performing also with the Madison Bach musicians in this pair of concerts they're giving, Dido and Aeneas, and the Coffee Cantata of Bach.
Yes, yes, exactly. We love going back to the classics as well, and it's great to play some Purcell and Bach. So you should definitely come Saturday night, Sunday afternoon to the Unitarian Church, and then also if you want to find out more about Bach and Beethoven experience, our website is bbexperience.org, and then we have lots of social, you know, we have all the social media platforms, and so so it's very easy to Google us. We have a YouTube channel, all that stuff. So
great. Well, Brandy Berry Benson, thanks for stopping by and sharing some interesting crossovers.
Yes.
Connections.
Thank you.